Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Hi, listeners. I'd like to invite you to visit our website at organicgardenerpodcast.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, download our ebook on organic gardening basics, and get started on building your very own organic oasis today. Welcome to the show today. I'm super excited to introduce Linda Kelso, who is the owner of LK Landscape Design, where she helps people make their landscapes more beautiful, enjoyable, and earth-friendly. So, of course, I asked her to come on the Organic Gardener Podcast, where we talk about growing organic and earth-friendly gardens and yards, and share with us some information about how to create an earth-friendly design that you can implement in your yard. So welcome to the show, Linda.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be interviewed.
Excellent. Well, go ahead and tell the audience a little bit about yourself.
Like you said, I'm a landscape designer, and I live near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I own my own business. This is my second year in business, actually, with LK Landscape Design. And right now, I specialize in using edibles as part of designs and using sustainable or native plants. And I guess the only other thing is that landscape design is really my second career. I have a bachelor's in psychology, and I spent about 10 years doing administrative and office manager kind of work. And I initially started into gardening as a hobby, and it just evolved into this new career for me.
Ooh, that sounds really interesting. we'll delve into it as we go along.
All right.
Well, so I always like to kind of start the show talking about your very first gardening experience. Like, how old were you? Were you an adult, a kid? Who were you with? What'd you grow? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I would say, I mean, my parents always had a small garden. Like, they would grow a few tomatoes or peppers, you know, when I was young. But my first kind of moment where I connected with gardening was in the wintertime, actually. My parents would receive seed catalogs in the mail, and I just thought they were beautiful. Like, I loved to look at the pictures and imagine the garden that I could create. And so I remember one year, I was probably 8 or 9 years old, I went and I actually got some of my dad's very expensive off-limits to me graph paper. And I grabbed my crayons and colored pencils, and I just sat and like designed my own vegetable garden. And I can remember doing that, you know, for a couple years. And I don't think any of them actually kind of made it into an actual garden. Like, I don't think my parents actually took those and made them into a reality, probably because they were pretty elaborate. But yeah, that's really the first time that I connected with gardening personally.
Oh, that sounds so fun. I love graph paper.
Yes,
and just doing any kind of thing like that. I'll bet it was super fun. And how interesting that you started so young.
Mm.
Okay, so do you want to share with us what organic gardening or earth-friendly gardening means to you?
I think that this definition is always evolving for me. Mm-hmm. But right now, it means working with nature rather than fighting against it. I guess I view nature as a system, and it's always trying to maintain balance. And if you can work within that system and try to maintain that balance, I think you'll end up successful, you know, with gardening. But it's when we introduce outside elements, like many types of chemical control or maybe like non-native plants and insects and animals, that you upset that balance, and then nature has to work really hard at adapting and establishing like normal again, if it even can. And I think that sometimes we use certain non-organic methods because they provide this short-term easy solution, but in the long term, they actually cause more problems. So I suppose to me, earth-friendly and organic also involves like a more long-term problem-solving view of things.
I love it. So true. Mm-hmm. And kind of goes along with a lot of what other guests on the show have said, that we can't just go with short-term quick fix solutions.
Yep.
We need to think about the long-term.
Yep.
health of our soil. And that was a big, I just went to this Aero conference where they talked about sustainable agriculture. And that was a big conversation at that conference, was how to create healthy soils and keep them for the long term. Okay.
Yeah.
So who or what would you say inspired you to start using organic techniques?
Oh, I think that it's actually, it's not just one person or event or thing. It's kind of been a slow progression. So my parents always used a fairly organic approach. I don't think they would have called it that, or it was intentional on their part, but they always just had small gardens, and I don't really remember them using pesticides or herbicides. So I grew up not really connecting gardening with chemical control. But then I also live near Pittsburgh right now, and I have to say the city itself actually really inspires me. In the last few years, Phipps Conservatory in Pittsburgh has really played a huge role in my development as a landscape designer. They offer a lot of classes and conventions, and they're all focused on using earth-friendly or organic or sustainable techniques. And they actually just started a pilot chapter of the Biophilia Network. I don't know if this is anywhere else right now. I think they're testing it out here first. But these are basically monthly meetings where you can listen to thought leaders and innovators in the organic and sustainable movement. They're like little TED Talks almost. And you get to ask them questions and connect with others who are interested in the green movement. I really love those meetings, and I try to attend whenever I can. And then I would say that just like Pittsburgh as a whole is making major advances in like greening up the city. They have nonprofit organizations like Grow Pittsburgh that focus on urban agriculture. And then there are buildings like the David L. Lawrence Convention Center, which I think is the first green certified convention center. So it's just a really, there's just a whole group of people here, and there's a whole movement here towards that. And it really is influencing my career path as well.
You know, that's so interesting. Pittsburgh, to me, I've been reading about Pittsburgh for, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 years now, and how they're one of the biggest innovators in the United States as far as changing. When the steel mills all closed, they were the first ones to embrace, wasn't it like medical, like healthcare? Like they have a huge healthcare medical center there, and some of the, you know, they just totally went the other way and embraced medical and technology. And now I did just read another article recently about how they're embracing the green movement and different things that were going on there. So it doesn't surprise me. It seems like Pittsburgh draws innovative people and extremely, you know, intelligent people and people who are really committed to changing the world. So excellent. So can I ask, like, where did you grow up? Did you grow up in Pennsylvania? Are you from Pittsburgh or?
Yeah, I'm from the Pittsburgh area. And then I actually, for 10 or 15 years after college, I lived out, you know, in different places. I lived in Las Vegas for a while, and then I lived in Seattle, which is another city that has a huge focus on organic and sustainable. And then about 5 years ago, I moved back here. And that's about when I kind of like transitioned into this new career.
So I was just going to tell listeners, I was just listening to a thing about what TED stands for. And TED actually stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design. So that's where TED Talks. If you've never listened to a TED Talk, definitely encourage you to listen to one of those. And I'm super excited to check out this. What did you say it was? Biophilia? Can you spell that for us?
Yeah, it's B-I-O-P-H-I-L-I-A.
So how did you learn how to garden organically?
Even though I'm a landscape designer, my whole history with gardening was with vegetable gardening. So when I went back to school for a degree in landscape design, I really wanted to kind of integrate some of that into what I do. So I discovered Rosalind Creasy. She is she does edible landscape design. Basically, she uses edible plants, fruits, vegetables, but she uses them in her landscape designs. So I kind of started down this kind of non-traditional road of design when I read her book. But then, I started to take classes at Phipps in sustainable design. I started to read other books about it. I just decided that if I was going to do this for a living, I wanted it to be more about than about just earning money. Like, I wanted to do something good with my work. I wanted to contribute to, you know, the environment and help it. So, yeah, that's how I started down that path.
Excellent. And I like the way you used multiple approaches. I think it's important to learn from various different sources. Now, what was the book? And what, can you spell her last name? Rosalind Creasy?
All right. The book is called Edible Landscaping. Now You Can Have Your Gorgeous Garden and Eat It Too. And the author's name is Rosalind Creasy. It's, her last name is Creasy.
Excellent. Okay. And I'll hook all the, link all that up in the show notes.
Yeah. It's
cool.
A really good-
so like edible landscape, does that mean like vegetables or like eating flowers or both?
It's all of it. You know, it's combining ornamental landscape plants with these edibles, which they can be vegetables, they can be herbs, they can be flowers. And a lot of what she talks about, and also if you look a little bit into maybe like the permaculture movement, there's this idea of like plants doing double duty. So not just looking nice, but serving some sort of other purpose in your landscape. So, and in terms of using, you know, vegetables and fruits and things like that, it's also this idea of, it's not just about like the tomato that you get or the leaves of the herb you get. It's maybe letting things go to flower because, you know, some things produce really pretty flowers. Or looking at the leaves of the plant in addition to the fruit or the vegetable that it produces. So, yeah, I would, obviously Rosalind Creasy, she explains it a lot better than I do. But she has a lot of books on the topic and she also has, a website about it too. So it's well worth checking out.
Excellent. I think listeners are really going to like that and be interested. And you did a nice job of summarizing it for us to kind of spark our interest. So way to go. And I think probably she's going to have influenced you and we're going to hear a little more of her influences in your story as you tell us about things that grow. So do you want to tell us about your landscape and like what grew well this year or what?
Yeah, I want to tell you about my parents' landscape because I had them do an experiment for me. So my parents, yes. My parents have about 2.5 acres of property, and I'm really, whenever I design, I try to take into account like not just the plants, but also the insects and the other animals that they support. So on my parents' property, like part of it is always trying to kind of turn into this meadow area. And so I asked my dad, well, could you just stop mowing a portion of that, like just a small part in the back? And I wanted to let it grow and go a little wild. And, you know, I wanted mostly to see, would it increase the numbers of butterflies and birds and bees around their yard? And he agreed. And I think it worked. Like what I noticed was that there were so many wildflowers growing in that unmowed portion. And when all the other normal landscape plants in the neighbor's yards had stopped blooming, like their part of their yard was full of these wildflowers. And so there were always lots of butterflies and moths and bees back there. I heard a lot more birds. And my dad was also happy because it was less mowing for him. I don't know if the neighbors were happy, but, So, I mean, you know, even simple things like that can actually, I think, make a difference to, you know, to the animals that share our spaces with us.
Absolutely. So, yeah. So now they must, I mean, that's a pretty big piece of land, isn't it?
Yes. Yes.
So they must be a little bit more out in the suburbs or?
Yeah, it's definitely more rural. There's a lot of farmland around where they live. So I don't think that you would get away with that if you lived in a housing plan or if you lived in a more like suburban area, but they were able to.
Now, one of your most recent blog posts talked about the law and design. Do you want to talk about that at all?
Oh, yeah, let me think about that. So I was just writing that when you when you design or whenever you do anything on your property, you have to take into account that there are a lot of local ordinances and maybe rules within a housing. There's, you know, what do they call them? HOAs, I think, or mm-hmm. I forget what those are called. But
Homeowner associations.
Yeah. So whenever you design something, it's fine to say, oh, I want to put a shed up in my yard, or I want to build a deck. But you always have to be aware that there are local laws and ordinances that govern that. And sometimes when you hire a contractor to do those installations, and this isn't always, but sometimes you have to read the contract carefully, because if some of those laws or ordinances are violated in the contract, you as the homeowner might be liable for that. So in that entry, I was just making the point that as a homeowner, you have to be kind of aware of what they are. And if you're building a deck or anything, or if you're having somebody else especially build it, make sure you understand what those rules are so that you can, you know, not only keep yourself safe, but keep yourself on the right side of the law.
Yeah, I think that's super important. Our very first and only really investment property that we sold was this little house in Cut Bank where I was teaching over on the east side. And they told me that like even painting the front door and changing the color of the front door required a permit. And then we had put up like a fence and built a walkway and planted trees, and just the landscaping was a big part of what, and put up like a window shutter type things, and all of that had to be approved. So, and this is like tiny town in Montana.
Yeah.
Like I had no idea that we would have to have things like that checked out. So that's a super important part. And like, you know, simple things like painting the front, the color of the front door. Like I never thought that would be something. So yeah, excellent topic. Okay. How about something new that you're excited to try next year?
I really want to use more permaculture techniques in my design. I'm just learning about permaculture now, and I think the whole subject of it is fascinating because it approaches gardening as a system, which is very appealing to me. That's kind of how I think about it anyway. I've been reading and really loving a book called Gaia's Garden by Toby Hemenway. And it's just a really common sense approach to working with nature in your own backyard. And plus a lot of permaculture elements, like there's a structure called an herb spiral, for instance, are just really beautiful and I think would look good in a landscape anyway. So my goal over the winter is to study more about that and start using that in my design work in the future.
Okay, what's it called again?
An herb spiral.
An herb spiral. Yeah.
Yes. Sorry. I don't know how well I'll describe this, but it's sort of like a raised bed, but instead of just being like one level, it's like multiple tiers or levels. It's literally like a spiral that goes upward. And it creates little environments for each herb. So like you might plant certain kinds at the top where they would get the most sun, or some of them on the sides where they would have a little bit more shelter. It's really attractive. And the way that I've seen it used is, you know, you can put herbs in it, but you can also plant flowers in it or other things like that. And it's very attractive.
Is it almost kind of like one of those mandala things?
I guess so, except you're thinking like upward. So it's
Like how big are they? Like, and I guess you could make it any size you want, but like would a small one be like 4 feet? And is it like a snail shell? Like
That's a good way to look at it. Yeah, and you can make it any size you want. I don't think that you would. I think anything less than maybe 4 or 5 feet at the base would be a little bit too small, but I had a client, she didn't end up using the idea, but I was designing one for her that at the largest part at the base was, I think, 8 feet in diameter. And, you know, and then each section upward got smaller and smaller. It's
cool. That sounds so exciting and interesting. I'm going to have to look into that. That's interesting. You know, I never heard of permaculture till I started this podcast 8 months ago anyway, either. Never knew what it was.
Yeah, I there was a student in one of my classes, one of my landscape design classes, who was really into it. And he's like, you got to look it up. You got to look it up. And I was like, oh, my goodness, I'm so busy, blah, blah, blah. And then when I finally had time to look into it, I was like, this is amazing. I totally want to make this a part of, you know, my design work. So, yeah.
And Kelly Ware, who has been on, she's been on my show twice now, but she's been in my top 10, mostly my top 5 most downloaded episodes. So people must be very interested. And she's talking about building a permaculture education center. She just moved to Panama.
Oh, wow.
Like, she's just been posting pictures of her house, her new house. They just moved down there in the last month or so, and she's gonna maybe start a permaculture education center down there.
Wow.
So that's awesome. Okay, so I'm very curious. I don't want to forget to ask you, like, how do you start a design? Like, what are the basics? Because I know, like, so then my number one most downloaded episode is Megan Kane from the Creative Vegetable Gardener. And I think she's downloaded a lot because she really talks about being strategic and planning things and really thinking. Like, I never think about that. I'm just like, go out, standing there with a plant in my hand, where am I going to put this today? I planted 750 sunflower seeds, and every one of them was like, what bed should I put this? Whatnot, you know, like, no, next year that's gonna be one of my big things, is thinking about it, which seeds go where beforehand.
Yes.
So what are your and I saw you had some things on your blog, so I don't want to forget to ask you, like, if you were going to tell people, what would you say to start, or how do you start your designs?
Well, a lot of people, I mean, I think like you do, which is that you start with the plants, like you buy them and then you kind of find a place for them. But the way that I look at it is that landscape design is actually problem solving. So I always start with interviewing the client and then also walking around the property. And what I'm looking for is problems they're having, maybe, like, maybe there's a drainage problem, or maybe there's an area where things aren't growing very well, or maybe they have something like really like nosy neighbors and they want a little bit more privacy, or they do want a vegetable garden, but they have, like, deer are an issue and they eat them, everything that you plant. So I kind of start with what the client wants and what the client needs and what problems they're having in their yard. And then I start creating a design based on that to deal with all of those issues. And, you know, a lot of times you can't fix everything or solve everything, but I try to, like, prioritize the needs and the wants and the problems so that whenever they have a final design, it's not something that just looks pretty, but it's also serving a purpose. And also, you know, I look at, you know, say they have all these sunflowers they want to plant, like, well, how much space do they need? How, like, not only, like, how much space does that plant need when it's young, but when it gets big, will it have enough room? I think one of the problems that I have seen in a lot of places when I do garden maintenance is people that put in shrubs and then they gave them enough space when they were small, but now that they're fully grown, it's just, they're crowding out everything. There's just not enough room. So I think about the design in terms of not only what does it look like when you first put it in the first year, but what is it going to look like, you know, 10 or 15 years down the road. So there's a lot of research and analysis that goes into a design before I even ever pick the flowers or other plants out.
Wow. That's a lot to think about.
Yes.
I think that's why you're the expert.
Yeah. Well, people are always like, people wonder, you know, if you hire a landscape designer, the cost of that can be in the thousands of dollars. And a lot of people wonder, like, why would it be so expensive? You're just bringing in plants. But they don't see that behind that, there is a lot of research and there's a lot of analysis that goes into that, you know, and there's a lot of expertise that goes into that, too.
Mm-hmm. And it can make a big difference and save you not just money, but a lot of frustration and a lot of time in the long run. And then, you know, there's definitely people like me out there and that are doing things haphazardly and then they have mistakes. And also, you know, a big one to think about is probably trees. Do you?
Yes.
What kind of things do you think about for trees?
I think a lot about the final size of the tree, and I think about the potential, it's a lot of things, but in terms of the final size of the tree, for instance, I don't want to plant 100-foot tall, you know, maple or oak tree, like right next to a house, for instance, because if that tree ages or is damaged, it could damage the house if it falls. And I don't want to take a tree that is going to, you know, produce a lot of seeds, like just to pick on maple trees again, they have, like, some of them, they just produce a lot of seeds and they get everywhere and they kind of can get invasive. But beyond that, I also consider how can they help the homeowner with their energy bills. So if you plant a tree in the correct place, it can provide shade in the summer. And then if it's a tree that loses its leaves, it'll let the sun in the winter. And you can do that with, you know, shrubbery too. But, you know, when choosing a tree, you have to think about, like, safety. You have to think about, you know, the mess that it might create or if it can get invasive. And, you know, can it help with the energy bills? I guess I think about that too.
And also the leaves would create compost.
Yes.
But definitely, passive solar is so huge and people don't really always think about the opportunities for your energy bill and savings that, you know, where your house, where your windows are, where your trees are, for sure. All right. Do you want to tell us about something that didn't work the way you thought it was going to this season?
Yeah, I think... actually, in when I started my business, I thought, okay, I'm going to just create all edible or all native plant or completely sustainable designs. And what I found is my clients aren't ready for that yet. What they're ready for is maybe popular landscape plants mixed with some native or some sustainable or some edible plants. Just because what I'm doing is a pretty different way to think about design right now in the area where I'm at. So it's a step-by-step process, which I totally get. And I think that if you're a homeowner, it's a big risk to pay for and use a design that's really maybe very different from what the neighbors have. And I'm okay with that. I would rather have a landscape designed with a few natives and a few edibles than none at all. And what I'm finding is that as clients see how things work and how they look, and they see that the designs aren't really off the wall. I really design with the neighborhood in mind so that a place doesn't, you know, it's not like, whoa, that's the sustainable house. It's not like that at all.
With the carrots like on the front walk that you can just pick right there or something like that.
They're like, whoa, what did they just do? There's a lot of education that goes with it. And as I develop relationships with clients, they become more open to using more earth-friendly techniques. And I think what I've discovered too is there is a lot of interest in things like using raised beds and composting and, you know, avoiding pesticides and herbicides. So when I design or when I do maintenance work, I really try to teach clients. Like, I usually they do have a lot of questions, and so I try to answer them from, you know, that kind of organic or sustainable perspective and show them how to use more sustainable tools and techniques.
What would you do? You have like a question you feel that a lot of people ask a lot?
I get a lot of pruning questions. There's a lot of, and because that's part of my business, like I prune and weed and things like that. So a lot of people like don't understand the right time of year to prune. And also, I don't know if it's like this where you live, but where I live, there in the past generation or so, there was this idea that you had to prune things into like little geometric shapes, like circles and squares and stuff like that. So
like that topiary type of,
yeah,
like they have those little topiary plants.
Yeah. But like everything, everything is pruned like
Edward Scissorhands.
Yes, that's what it's like. But the problem is, if you prune a plant like that continuously, you can eventually end up killing the plant, and you certainly make it less healthy, and it's certainly more susceptible to attack by insects or diseases. So a lot of times when people hire me, they hire me because one thing I do is I can revitalize those plants or start to get them growing back in a more natural way. So I get a lot of questions about, you know, how do you do that? How, like, why is pruning this plant into a box killing it? You know, that kind of question. and then I get some about, you know, just controlling weeds without the use of herbicides and that sort of thing. So yeah, those are probably the most common.
And Russ Medge, who is from Salt Lake City and has a fruit tree pruning business, or it might not even be just fruit trees, but a tree pruning business. Mm-hmm. He's been my downloaded episode number 2 and 3 consistently since I interviewed. And he was like episode number 28, which I think I still even need to fix his sound, but he definitely, somebody told me about this cool thing called Alphonic, and I keep meaning to upload his episode to Alphonic and see if that'll help the sound on his episode. But it's been, people really like that. And then Dave Salmon, who's down in New Mexico, talked about pruning flowering trees and the difference between pruning a fruit tree and pruning a flowering tree and how important that is. And then both of them, but especially Dave, talked a lot about the native plant landscaping and people who move to the New Mexico from the East Coast and want to plant things in their yards that, you know, grow on the East Coast that just are not going to grow in New Mexico. How about something that you find is easy to grow and generally successful every time? Like, is there a plant that you get people started with, like a native plant or an earth-friendly thing that you start most people out with?
Yeah, I really like to use herbs as ornamentals. I think that they're easy to grow and maintain, and they're really pretty too. So some of my favorites are basil, especially if you prune it properly, so it gets kind of like that bushy growth habit. And I really like how sage and rosemary look too. And another thing, I did an experiment this year. I planted Swiss chard as an ornamental. I was really impressed by how it looked and how it performed, and that it was just very little work involved with it. And the plants were huge by the end of the season. So, but yeah, I think that if somebody like wants to start integrating edibles into their landscape, herbs are a really good place to start.
I totally agree. Plus, they have that whole aromatherapy piece to them because they smell so good. And they do have lovely flowers, and the bees love them. The bees are always on my herbs all summer long. And I like the way, like, the first thing to bloom are my chives. And so they go there, and then they move on to the oregano, which I'm overrun with oregano always. And then the other things. And sage has really pretty flowers, too.
Does
rosemary? I don't even know if rosemary. I planted a new rosemary bush this year, I'm hoping. But I got it at the farmer's market in Kalispell, I'm hoping is going to bloom next year.
Mine, I just planted one this year as well in my garden. It hasn't bloomed, but I really like the look of the leaves. Like, that's another thing in design. Like, it's good to like mix up different textures, like different leaf types and things like that. So I just like that rosemary has this completely different, like the leaves are just little needles. And I like the contrast of that with other more broadleaf plants. And it smells good.
And, you know, the thing about herbs is the best way to smell them is just like grab a leaf and crumble it in your fingers and then smell your fingers.
Yep.
How about something you would steer people away from putting in their landscape that's typically challenging to grow?
My answer to that is Japanese barberry. This is like my plant nemesis. I really hate it. if you're not familiar with it, it's a shrub that's covered in these tiny, sharp, painful thorns. And people like it because it's low maintenance and really nothing much is going to attack or eat it. But to me, the pros do not outweigh the cons. I think that it went through this phase where a lot of designers and nurseries were recommending it to homeowners because where I live, at least, I see it in almost every landscape. But as somebody who has had to prune this many times, you need leather gloves to prune it because of the thorns. And if and they're really tiny, so if they get in your skin, they're really hard to get out. I actually had a have a friend and a former coworker. She's had a barberry thorn in her arm for years, and they're painful. Plus, there has been some research coming out recently that shows they provide the sort of environment that ticks like to breed in. And then they're also invasive. So birds will eat the berries, which means the seeds get distributed wherever the birds go. And once it's introduced into like the woods or woodland, it can start to crowd out native plants. So it's not my favorite plant by any means. And yeah, I would not recommend it for the landscape.
Okay. Great advice. What would you say is your least favorite activity to do in the garden? Is that it? Pruning those Japanese barberries? Or is there something else that's even worse?
No, you know what? Mulching. In my own garden, it's not a big deal because my garden is just in a smaller space. But when I do it for clients, then it's on a very large scale. And it's just... it's a stress fest for me, I'm not going to lie, because whenever you mulch for somebody, you measure everything and then you calculate how much you need. And I am doing and redoing those calculations like up until the day before the stuff is delivered because I'm always so paranoid that I didn't order enough or maybe I ordered too much. And is the delivery guy going to be able to find the place? And, you know, is he going to be able to dump the mulch? And I get so stressed out about it. I've never had a mulch job go wrong, but it's stressful and it is a good workout. Like you are tired and your body is sore after a big mulching job.
What do you use to mulch?
For like clients, it's usually a wood chip mulch. There's different kinds around. In my own garden, like sometimes leaves or, you know, just kind of what's available around where I live. But yeah, for clients, for more of a landscape kind of job, I use the wood chips.
Excellent. We just got a chipper. We're so excited. Last Monday. So we're super excited to be able to, and it will take up to a 3-inch diameter. So we're not only will it chop, you know, because we live in the woods. Oh, that's what I was gonna say, is that so when I first met Mike, we had 20 acres of pretty much Christmas trees, and how he had pruned the trees, and that people don't realize a lot of the Christmas trees you see in the store have been pruned, and some people even spray paint where they've cut them. So what he would do, his trees, he would prune them, and then the year he was going to sell them, he wouldn't prune them that year, so that final growth on the end was still the natural growth. But he would go around every spring and spend hours out in our property. But we don't sell Christmas trees anymore, so they've kind of all grown up. That was what I was thinking about the tree part. Oh, I knew there was something about it. Back to the mulch. Yeah, so we're excited to have more wood chips to use for mulch. And then also, like, the big thing that's always been hard for us to break down is, like, corn stalks. And then, of course, this year there's all my sunflower stalks. And just to be able to create more mulch for our... property. So yeah, that's cool.
I like use that. The sunflower stalks. I like that idea.
Yeah, because I grew a lot of, and some of them are huge and they're just thick. Yeah. So it'll be nice to be able to chop all that stuff up and really get some healthier. Because that is the other thing. Like, I think in Montana, one of the hardest things has been finding soil when you build a raised bed, is finding the soil to put into it. And so, to me, that's always been a tough one. Yeah, finding not just soil, but also the other one is manure that hasn't been fed. All right, now how does it go? I always get this confused. So if they're cows that ate, is it non-weed or non-something food, then you don't want it. Because that means it has pesticides in it. They've had the...
Usually,
I always get this mixed up because usually I think it's non-something, it's going to be good. But if they've been eating non-weed... If they've been eating weed-free hay, it means that they have chemicals in their hay and they're not organic. And so you can't use... Wow. You shouldn't be using that manure in it. It's been, I guess, wreaking some havoc around our valley. Patty... Now, Peggy Jane Owsley, who worked in Eureka at the local nurseries for many, many years and has always been a big gardener, was on my show in the beginning. And she was one of the first people to talk about that, that we have a big problem in our valley with people have gotten this manure and then they're getting weeds in their, or their stuff is not growing. Their stuff is getting almost burnt from the manure that they used. Anyway.
Oh, that's interesting. I've never heard of that. I'm going to have to look into that now. Yeah, I live or where my parents live, actually, there's a lot of farmland around there. And so it's, you can find, you know, manure and things like that from that. But I've never thought to look into that before. I'm going to have to, I'm going to have to add that to the list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I've learned a ton since I started doing this podcast. Mm-hmm. It's been great. And I think I've gotten a lot of good feedback from listeners that they have too. So yeah, we're all learning and we're all like, I always thought our chickens were organic. And then I realized, well, I can't afford to buy them organic chicken feed. Mm-hmm. So I guess, you know, because I always thought, you know, we fed them our scraps from our compost. And then even that, you know, as much of the food as we grow, you know, I still buy broccoli all year round. And
yeah.
The broccoli I buy, I can't afford to buy organic broccoli. So, you know, feeding them that, I guess, technically. So, but I don't sell our eggs anyway, so.
And I think, like, it's the way I look at it, because there's so much that you could go crazy trying to do it all. I really think, like, you do as much as you can and you try to learn more and I've looked at it as doing something is better than doing nothing. And it's like an evolution. Like you kind of learn what you want to integrate into your life and what you can't at that time. And, you know, it's just.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're all trying to do our best, I think. So
yes.
I think we're closer than somebody who, you know, my eggs aren't grown in, you know, in a big factory farm. So
that, you know, exactly.
My chickens now, they don't even stay, like, we've given up on. They just get out all they want. They climb on the fence. They're jumping up in the trees. They're getting in and out all the time. They're in the garden. I have no way to keep them out of the garden at this point. So I don't know what we're going to do by next spring. We're going to have to figure something out. But they have broke free. For years, I begged Mike to build me a gate so the chickens could get out into the woods part and not get into the garden. And it was going good this summer. And then recently, they have figured their own way out. And they all sleep up on the fence. The rooster sleeps on this big Douglas fir tree, like 15 feet up. And the chickens sleep on the fence right near him. It's pretty cute. But, yep.
Anyway. When I lived in Seattle, in the city of Seattle, they allow you to keep chickens. And I used to live with a couple different roommates, and our neighbors got chickens, and they had a rooster, which technically you're not supposed to have in the city, but you know, it happens. And so that rooster would like escape into our yard every so often. So we'd have to go on like rooster herding duty and get it back to them. It was kind of fun, actually.
I know, they're so fun. Our rooster totally marches these chickens. They used to just go around the outside of our big fenced yard, which is, it's a pretty big yard. And now they march around the inside of the fence, and he just, you know, stands behind the chickens and they just make this line right up the fence line. It's so cute. But yeah, roosters are fun. Okay. So what's your favorite activity to do?
I really enjoy pruning, and I enjoy like teaching people about pruning. I think it's really an almost lost skill, and it is an art. And when you do it well, you create a beautiful plant and you create a healthier plant. So whenever I'm doing a pruning job, it's like, it's always a very like peaceful kind of thing, but it's also an artistic thing. So yeah, I really enjoy pruning.
Are there any tips you would give to listeners that they should always make sure they do when they're pruning a plant or a tree?
Yeah, it's important to step back every so often and just look at the plant as a whole and like walk around it and don't prune a bunch in one place at a time. Like prune a little bit in one place, then move around to a different part of the plant and prune there, and just keep stepping back and looking at it. That kind of gives you a perspective on what you're doing so that you don't end up with something that's really like lopsided. And if you're just starting to learn how to prune, don't use like electric anything. It's going to go too fast for you probably. Like it'll be too easy to kind of lop off too much of the plant. Just use hand pruners or, you know, like the hand shears. But yeah, and it's really hard to, if you incorrect, like plants are pretty tough and they want to survive. So it's fairly hard to kill a plant through pruning unless, like I said before, you do that kind of really like tight geometric shape year after year after year. But, you know, so don't be afraid. Like go out there, kind of read a little bit about the plant, like look at how it's supposed to look naturally, and read up a little bit about pruning, but then just go do it. That's just the best way to learn. That's my advice.
Those are great tips. That's excellent advice. You're such an artist in your own way. Okay, tell us about the best crop or the best landscape design you ever did or created, or what was your favorite project that you worked on?
I will talk about a project that I got to do in class, like classroom projects. Sure. I always liked them because you never really had a budget limit and, you know, you could just kind of go crazy with the design. So I did a design drawing once for, it was like it needed to match kind of this colonial style house. And I just got to go really crazy and have fun with it. Like I had chicken coop. I had like a whole raised bed garden section. I had like a whole work area. And what I was doing was that if you look at like early American designs or even some British landscape designs, you know, from the past, you know, you had your landscape design had to support your life. So you had to be growing things that you could eat. You had to have work areas, like you needed chickens or your garden or whatever. So those older designs, I really like them because they integrate all of that. And for me personally, like I love things that are beautiful, but I love things that are practical too. So even when I talk to clients or when I, you know, do designs for my company, I'm always thinking about like those more practical things that I can work into them that are also pretty and fun. So,
Yeah, that's the whole part of having a garden, I think, or part of what I like to, you know, make things convenient and easy and simple, but enjoyable.
Yes.
How about the best gardening advice you ever received?
That would be from my dad. He would tell me, don't overwhelm yourself and start small. And he would tell me that in terms of gardening and I think in life in general. But in terms of gardening, you know, when I was younger and maybe not so young, I would get really excited and I'd want to try like 20 different new plants at a time or 20 different new projects. And my dad would always kind of rein me in and say like, well, instead of 20 things, why don't you try two or three new things and observe how they do, how the plants grow, if you like them or not, and then you can try them again next year and then maybe try some other new things. So that's advice that I share with people, in particular, like clients who are new to gardening, especially vegetable gardening, because I think that they, you know, they look through the catalogs and they get really excited and maybe there's like, you know, 50 different vegetables they want to try. And I'm just like, well, start with five. Like, you'll be surprised at how far that will go for you. So yeah, start small.
I'm totally guilty of that. Yeah, that's great advice. Okay, so I just thought this keeps bugging me. So what did your dad do? What was the super, like, you're not supposed to touch graph paper for? Is he an architect or a math teacher or a scientist? Or what's he do?
He worked at, there's a company called Westinghouse. and he worked in their nuclear sciences division. He was a technician there, and he's always been like, my dad is amazing. Like he doesn't even have a college degree or anything like that, but he is just really scientifically minded. And so these machines that they had at Westinghouse, like he just has this like intuitive sense of how to make them work and improve them and fix them. And I think a lot of, you know, my own, like I always have this desire to experiment and try to change things up and make them better. And I got a lot of that from him. So yeah, kind of like an engineering type thing is what he was really involved in.
Awesome. I might talk to you afterwards about, I have a friend who's starting a business call or a podcast called The Intuitive Business. He mm-hmm. might make a good guest on her show.
Be awesome.
Okay. How about, I think I know what you're going to say, but let's see. A favorite tool that you like to use. Like if you had to move and can you use one tool, what would it be?
Oh, okay. So I was thinking about this and I couldn't narrow it down to one tool. There's okay. two that I use all the time. So
that's fine.
The first are my Felco pruners. Felco.
Right, that's
is the
what
company.
I thought.
Yep. I love them. They are just, they're such a well-made tool and I use them on every maintenance job. They stay sharp for a long time and they stand up to a lot of abuse. And I think if you're a home gardener who just does occasional pruning, a pair would last you a long, long time. And, what I like about them too is they make a version that's a little smaller, which is nice if you like, if I have smaller hands, so that makes it a lot more comfortable to do a lot of pruning work. And then my second is my Duluth Dry on the Fly pants, which I know it's kind of funny to think of pants as a tool, but these mm-hmm. are my work pants and I love them. Every maintenance job or every time I'm out in the field, I have these on. And the material that they're made of is really lightweight and stretchy, but it's strong. I worked for a garden maintenance company before I started my own company. And the first season that I worked for them, I wore jeans. And my jeans just like wore out after a couple months. But these pants, like I've used them for 2 hard gardening seasons now and they look perfect. Like they don't have any stains or tears or I don't even know how it's possible. And plus I like them because they're so lightweight, even if it's a really, really hot day, I'm comfortable in them and I don't have to like, I can keep my legs covered, which is something that I like for safety reasons when I'm pruning or out working. So yeah, I really
cool.
like
I'm going to have
pants.
To look into those for Mike because he goes through jeans like crazy.
Yeah, I love
yeah, I think those are great tips. I think they're totally, I'm so glad you gave 2. Perfect. How about, I'm going to skip right over all the cooking. I don't know. Did you have any kind of like a cooking or a recipe or anything?
Well, You had a question about like a favorite recipe. Mm-hmm. So I'm always trying new recipes and I'm always experimenting, which probably drives the people that I cook for crazy because they never get the same thing. So I don't have a favorite recipe, but I have favorite flavors. And most of them come out of my garden. So I really love the flavors in Thai food, in Mexican and Indian food. And a lot of those recipes use the kind of things I grow, like tomatoes or peppers or basil or lemongrass or cilantro. So I actually specifically grow those things in my garden. So I have access to fresh ingredients for those kinds of recipes.
Oh, come on. You got to share one recipe with us after that big lineup.
let me think. Honestly,
especially you can make one up fresh because you said you never use the same ingredients twice.
Well, okay, so I'm afraid like somebody's gonna listen to this and they're gonna really know how to cook Thai food and they're gonna be like, this girl. So there's one that I just kind of make up on the fly. I don't think that it's totally legit, but I like everything that goes in it. So
That's okay. We'll just call it the LK Design recipe.
It's basically like a Thai peanut sauce, like a quick and dirty Thai peanut sauce. And I take a can of coconut milk and I add some peanut butter into it. And then there's like a sweet chili sauce that I use that I put a little bit of that in. And then mix that up, warm it up. And then if I have lemongrass, which I don't know if you've ever used that in cooking, but it gives this nice, like very subtle lemony flavor. And it's literally grass, but you cut it down at the base and you kind of peel off the outer layers. And so when you get to the middle of the grass stalk, it tastes and smells lemony. And so when I make that sauce, I just put a little bit of that grass stalk in there and let it, you know, boil for a while. And it kind of infuses that flavor in. And then I will usually, like, I'll have it on rice noodles or just regular rice. And I'll put, like, basil on top, or not basil, cilantro on top. So it's not, like, an official recipe or anything. But sometimes I just get, like, a really bad craving for those flavors. And I can put that together really fast. So...
That was one of the best recipes on the show. I love it. I love Thai peanut sauce. There's a restaurant called the Wrap and Roll Cafe near us that has a Thai peanut. What's it called? Like burrito or something.
Oh, my gosh. Oh,
they're so good. Mm. But I don't think they put that lemongrass. That sounds good. I'm going to have to try that. And you grow that right in your garden? Can I grow that in my garden? Does that have to go like where it's warm? Or?
No, I'm similar climate. I'm like zone 6 and it grows. I mean, if you're in a warmer climate, I think that it will be perennial. But for me, it's just annual. But like it looks like a decorative grass. So you could even use it decoratively, like on an annual basis, I guess. But yeah, it's just like this huge, like I think that it grew to about 4 or 5 feet tall and it's really sharp. Like I didn't realize that at first. So like I just like reached in to cut off like a stalk at the bottom and like sliced up my fingers. So you might want to wear like gloves or something or just be really careful when you go to harvest it. But we haven't had our first frost yet, but it's going to kind of get close to that point now. So I'm going to just cut a lot of it off at the base and prep it. And then I'm going to freeze it and see how it works. So, because there was way more, like you just need one plant and that would be more than enough for, I think, you know, many dishes.
All right, cool. How about a favorite internet resource? Where do you like to go to find information on the web?
I really love Pinterest. I get a lot of design inspiration from there. Like I'm very visual. So if I'm thinking about a design or working on a design, like I like to look at just different pictures and get inspiration from that. So, I have my own account and I have like a gazillion landscape design and gardening boards on there where I just like keep track of all my ideas. And even when I'm designing for clients, sometimes like I'll create like a specific board for them and, you know, I can share it with them and put my ideas in there so that they can kind of look at it as well.
Excellent. I'm going to have to check that out. We'll put a link to your Pinterest page in the show notes because I'm sure other listeners will too. How about a favorite reading material, like a book or magazine or a blog that you can recommend for listeners?
I really like Garden Design Magazine. It's just a gorgeous publication and it has great information and no ads. It's targeted at landscape designers, but I think that a homeowner would get a lot out of it too. And what's nice is that in the back part of the magazine, there are sections for like different areas of the country, like Northeast, South, Midwest. So you can get design ideas specific to where you are. But yeah, it's really pretty. It even makes like a nice, you know, like those coffee table books. Like it's just that pretty. You could even use it for that. And then, like I said before, Edible Landscaping by Rosalind Creasy. I also love this book called Bringing Nature Home by Doug Talamay. It's just this really eye-opening explanation of why using native plants are important, is an important thing. And then Gaia's Garden by Toby Hemenway, which is that book about permaculture that I'm reading now. I think that gives really clear, very accessible explanations. So, yeah.
Cool. Great resources. I think a couple of those have been mentioned before, but it's always good to have them again.
Yeah.
And just so you know, listeners, I'm working on a page on our website that has like the recommend books that have been recommended on the show. So getting that put together. So since you have a business, do you have any advice for listeners if they wanted to get started in the landscape design industry?
I do. So I would say if you are thinking about it, try to find a summer job with a garden maintenance company or a landscape design company. I just think it's important to work for somebody else first because you get to learn the business side of things and you'll get some really great hands-on training. Plus, you'll know if you really like it and if it's something you want to turn into a career because, you know, designing or doing maintenance for somebody else for money is a very different feeling than doing it for yourself. And I would say take some classes. You don't need a degree to be a landscape designer, but I think that it is important. And I think that it helps you understand the whys behind why you do things, like why you prune at a certain time or knowing how to identify certain plants. And then there's a book that was really helpful to me as I was transitioning into this new career, and that is So You Want to Be a Garden Designer, and the author is Love Albrecht Howard. It's a really comprehensive guide about all the things that a landscape designer might do and kind of how to approach it and how to approach clients. I mean, it was just, anybody that I know that wants to do this as a business, like, I'm like, you need to read this book. And I would also say find other local businesses or business communities online and plug into them. You need people who can inspire you and encourage you and keep you accountable to your goals. And like nobody's going to understand the trials and the tribulations and the joys of running a business like other business owners. So yeah, those are my recommendations.
Excellent. Yeah. I just got an accountability partner through my podcasting group, and he's been huge in helping me move forward. And just, it's really nice. Like, he's probably spent more time on my website than anybody and just has looked through it and really given me concrete advice on how to improve it. And just, it's really nice to have somebody like that out there. Okay, here's our final question. Ready? If there's one change you would like to see, Linda, to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or a project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
Oh, so I think there are so many pressing issues out there, and sometimes it can be so overwhelming and even discouraging to think about all of them. But one goal that I have is to spread the message that we as individuals can do simple things in our own backyards and front yards to help solve or at least alleviate these problems. So, you know, for instance, there is this really troubling decline in the pollinator population. And there's a lot of theories about why that's happening. But I mean, at the same time, you, as an individual, it's hard to go out in your backyard and see fewer bees and fewer butterflies. So, you know, for example, if you think about monarch butterflies, there's this big population decline. People are really worried about it. And there's this great movement that's encouraging people to plant milkweed, which is a great step in the right direction. But, you know, maybe somebody, they have a butterfly bush in their back, in their yard already, and they see a lot of butterflies around it, and they see monarchs, and they think, well, why would I need to plant milkweed? Like, I've already got something for the monarch butterflies. Well, the problem is that while monarchs can consume the nectar from the butterfly bush, they don't lay their eggs on it. They only lay their eggs on milkweed because that's the only plant that the monarch caterpillars can eat. So the butterfly bush doesn't support the whole life cycle of the monarch. And if there's no milkweed growing, then the monarch can eat, but it can't produce the next generation of butterflies. But like, there's a simple solution, which is that you don't have to change your whole yard. You just need to plant some milkweed. Any homeowner can do that. And if enough people do that, then that can create some significant change. So, I think it's the same for a lot of other insects and animals. You just can take these simple steps and plant these certain plants that will, you know, help deal with some of the problems, or you can stop using certain herbicides and pesticides. So, yeah, I'm really a fan of small steps in the right direction and of educating people and kind of helping them feel empowered to like make those changes on their in their own properties.
That was beautiful. I have tears in my eyes. Because especially, all right, so I just went to the Aero conference and somebody there was actually giving out the milkweed, the seeds, and encouraging people. And then Joyce Pinson, who was a guest on my show, posted this beautiful sunflower of a monarch butterfly in her yard. And then Dave Salmon, who I talked about from New Mexico, asked everybody to consider the monarch butterfly like our kind of logo, or just like keep that idea in our head because it's so true. But you really gave like some really concrete advice, explained it all, talked about how the butterflies lay their eggs only on the milkweed, because even with all these things, you're the first one that I didn't know that, and I didn't grab any of those milkweed seeds because I didn't read her information that whoever had that there at the conference. But I noticed Robin, who I went with, did she grabbed some of those seeds, of course. And just so important, and it's so true. And and so that's great. I didn't know. I have those butterfly flowers in my yard and didn't realize that I need milkweed too so they can lay their eggs. So thank you so much for sharing that. So do you have an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden or earth-friendly landscape?
I really think that in gardening, your perspective and your attitude are important. So I would say don't look at gardening as a succeed or fail kind of thing. Look at it as just a fun experiment, and you're going to make mistakes, and that's okay. You can just learn from them and keep trying. And as my dad told me, keep it simple and start small. So.
Awesome. Okay, do you want to tell listeners how to connect with you?
Yeah, they can visit my website, which is lklandscapedesign.com. And that's also where they can find my blog, which is called The Designer's Notebook. I'm also on Pinterest and Twitter, and I have a Facebook page. You can all find that links to that through my website. And if you wanted to contact me more directly, you can email me at linda@lklandscapedesign.com.
Excellent. Would we be remiss if we don't mention Katie? Linda and I met through one of my all-time favorite podcasters, Katie Kremitzos, who has the Biz Women Rock podcast. And then she started this online.
Oh, I said it's a great podcast.
Yeah, it is just, I love Katie. Her Facebook community group is the best. So if you're a woman and you are interested in, and you have a business or you work for a business or just anywhere, Katie's the best. And she's going to have a baby soon. I'm so excited because she and Chris are going to be great mom and dad. And that's how Linda and I met. So, you know, more power to Facebook. And I hope everyone, I think, I know listeners are going to love this episode. So thank you, Linda, so much for coming on and sharing your knowledge. You are just full of golden nuggets.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to check out our website, organicgardenerpodcast.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast.com. And you'll see the links to everything that we've talked about today in the show notes page and all the other episodes there. You can easily search for people by name. You can download our ebook on organic gardening basics and subscribe to our newsletter for updates and just different things that are going on. Thanks for listening, and remember to grow local.